This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today in the world of professional sports, which has become kind of a bellwether for whether some normalcy is possible during a global pandemic. The number of New England Patriot football players opting out of the 2020 NFL season due to the coronavirus is now up to 6, including star linebacker and defensive captain Dante Hightower. And the Red Sox are off to a miserable start to their coronavirus-shortened season, dropping 4 of their first 5 games with one of their starting pitchers out due to coronavirus complications. The world is watching, and not just the games, to see who will win in the matchup between professional sports and the coronavirus. So here to give us a read on what's happening is Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Tiziana. Thanks for having me. Spoiler alert, the news is not good on that front. We'll get into that, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, so let's start with football, and I'm going to ask you about the Patriots players opting out, the same question I've been asking so often during this pandemic. How big a deal is this?
So I'm going to answer your favorite question with probably your least favorite answer, which is it depends. I think you mentioned, I know, we're still in the midst, obviously, of a global pandemic, and I don't think anybody really knows exactly what the future is going to bring. We've heard a lot of talk about a possible second wave in the fall, and we're going to be seeing college students returning to campuses in a lot of places, kids going back to schools in some places. So I think it all of this discussion really depends on what the next few weeks and the next few months bring for us. We may not even have a football season. So with that huge caveat at the beginning of this answer, I would say on the field, it is actually a pretty big deal for the Patriots just because of the names of the players who have said they are opting out this year. You mentioned Dante Hightower. He's basically the quarterback of the defense. He's the guy who's out on the field calling the plays for the defense, moving guys around when they need to move. He's one of the true leaders on this team. Coach Belichick has named him Mr. February for all of his big plays in the postseason and Super Bowls. You also have Patrick Chung, who's kind of unheralded, but I think a big contributor who never really gets the recognition he deserves for the kind of flex role he plays on this team. You've got Marcus Cannon, who's been a pretty steady presence on the offensive line. Brandon Bolden, who's a special teams contributor. So you've got some pretty big name players who have said they will not be playing this year for the Patriots.
And clearly players who understand what the impact is of opting out. So what are they saying about this decision, about why they're doing it when they know what it's going to do to the team?
Yeah, totally. And it depends on the individual player. So in Dante Hightower's case, he just had a child about a month ago, and he says he thinks it's the right move for his family not to expose themselves to this kind of risk. Patrick Chung's wife is also expecting. You've also got a guy like Marcus Cannon, who is a cancer survivor. He is in that high-risk category should he get the coronavirus. So he's stepping away for health reasons. And basically, the league has said players can opt out for whatever reason they want. They don't have to specify why. Anybody who opts out gets the $150,000 base salary at the beginning of the year. And if they're in a high-risk category like a Marcus Cannon, they would get $350,000 at the beginning of the year. And then the rest of whatever they would have been paid this year basically just gets rolled over to next year. And I did want to note, I think it's interesting, the first player who decided to opt out of this upcoming season, and he did so literally hours after the league reached this agreement with players, was Kansas City Chiefs guard Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, who's actually a doctor. And I just wanted to read a portion of the statement that he put out when he announced his decision. "Being at the front line during this offseason has given me a different perspective on this pandemic and the stress it puts on individuals in our healthcare system. I cannot allow myself to potentially transmit the virus to our communities simply to play the sport I love. If I am to take risks, I will do it caring for patients." So pretty powerful sentiment there.
So you said earlier there might not be a football season. Are players opting out all over? Is that what is putting a season at risk?
Not yet, per se. The Patriots, you mentioned, have 6 players who have said they're opting out. There are only, at my last count today, 25 players league-wide who have said they're opting out. So there could be a couple of factors here. It's hard to guess at internal motivations for these decisions, but Belichick is known as a coach who's always trying to figure out an advantage, however small. It could be possible. He said, if you're going to opt out, tell me sooner rather than later so I know and can figure out what to do with the roster. It could be there's no deadline for players to opt out. So it could be that we'll see more opt outs as the calendar moves along here. But right now, the Patriots have a large chunk of the players who said they're not going to play this year.
All right. So let's turn our attention. We are Boston. You want to talk about the Red Sox?
No, I can't handle it. Come on. Don't do that to me.
All right. Well, we're going to have to. But let's just talk about baseball then for a second. Less than a week in. The world's been watching. It's the first pro sport really back. We've already seen the Miami Marlins season postponed after 17 people with the team have tested positive. I mean, so that's like a team that can't even play in this carefully orchestrated short season. How's baseball dealing with this? How will they?
I mean, in the long term, we have no idea. Again, we're in totally uncharted waters here. We've never dealt with anything like this. In the short term, they've basically put the Marlins on hold until August 3rd. They put the Phillies on hold until this weekend, who had been playing the Marlins when this news started to break. And they've had to already reshuffle the calendar because you've got teams like the Yankees and the Orioles who are supposed to play against these teams. So you have to do all of this kind of puzzling it out to figure out how to get as many games in as possible, especially when you have to put a couple of teams on the shelf. You're already talking about a condensed calendar, so there's limited time. The league has already said they're okay if they get to the end of the year and teams have not played an equal number of games, they'll deal with that. At that point, they would just rank teams by winning percentage versus actual numbers of wins. But really, in the long term, if this becomes a problem, if more than one team has a huge outbreak like this, I don't know how they make it work.
Yeah, once again, a bellwether, right, for so many other things.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people are watching to see if they can pull this off. All right,
yeah, and I've seen
I've
seen a lot of people say if a multi-billion dollar organization like baseball with thousands and thousands of tests being run over the course of a few days can't handle this, how does that change our thinking about college campuses and schools and things like that? Right. I think you're absolutely right. People are watching this pretty closely.
Exactly. And we will continue to, too. Before we let you go, though, I must torture you. We must
talk about our
team. I know. Let's talk about the Sox. The Sox.
It's been ugly. And it's an issue that we talked about last year. We talked about in the offseason. It's pitching. They have no pitching starters or bullpen, or they don't have enough anyway. They have a pretty solid lineup, which is interesting. And you would think that, okay, they should be able to hit their way into wins, and maybe they will in the long run over the course of the season. But so far, you can tell that the lack of pitching has really weighed on the offense. I want to play a cut here from Xander Bogaerts, who's known as being incredibly upbeat. He's a real leader in the clubhouse. He's a guy who's always kind of giving positive affirmation to folks and get them next time. Let's go do this. This is what he said after the loss on Monday.
It's tough. You know, obviously it's not just like one run, you know, it's a couple runs, and then they just find a way to add on some more before we can kind of get something going, you know, and it gets tough, you know.
And if you see the video that goes with that, he's shoulder slumped. He is depressed. And you can tell this offense is putting extra pressure on themselves, knowing they don't have the pitching to hold the other team down. Hitting a baseball is often called one of the hardest things to do in professional sports. That's why if you can do it 3 out of 10 times, you're considered really good. And so if you have that added pressure of now you have to produce runs or this team will lose, that really starts to weigh on you. It makes it even harder.
All right. So, Chris, we've got a little less than a minute left. So let me just ask you, because that was depressing. Any rays of hope to leave us with the rest of Titletown's pro sports teams?
I do have a little bit of hope, and this is something people are kicking baseball for not doing. The NBA and the NHL have created bubbles for their players to bring their seasons back, both of which will start towards the end of the week here. I think that is at least the best hope that we have to try to get some normalcy going in the world of sports. Baseball should have looked at it, but I do think the NBA and the NHL are going to be able to return in that bubble, assuming everybody follows the rules and they maintain those health restrictions. We'll see if we can at least get through a couple of seasons.
All right, Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
30 years ago this week, President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law. The ADA prohibits discrimination based on disability, making it one of the most influential pieces of civil rights legislation since the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
For too many Americans, the blessings of liberty have been limited or even denied. And the Civil Rights Act of 64 took a bold step towards righting that wrong, but the stark fact remained that people with disabilities were still victims of segregation and discrimination, and this was intolerable.
30 years later, in the midst of a global economic upheaval and a global pandemic, where are we on disability rights and equality, and what are the next frontiers? Joining us now to discuss this and to reflect on the 30th is Cortland Towns III, Deputy Director of the Boston Center for Independent Living, the nation's second ever independent living center. Cortland, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Sherry Blowett. She's a sports medicine specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where she directs the Kelly Adaptive Sports Research Institute. She's a two-time winner of the wheelchair division of the Boston Marathon. Dr. Blowett, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
So we have an ADA generation now. We have 30 years of people living with this act in place. So let's just start. Remind all of us of its impact on our lived world, on our workplaces, our families.
Sure. I mean, right now, because of the ADA, there's real access, you know, real access to schools, jobs, transportation, sidewalks. I mean, it's easy for folks to forget that there was a time when town halls, state houses, government buildings weren't accessible. People would go to vote and would not be able to get in. There was no guarantee of ASL interpreters for the deaf and hard of hearing, no guarantee of alternative formats for people that were blind or visually impaired. Even local cities and buses and subways oftentimes were not accessible. So we're not fully there yet as far as full access and complete access for folks. But it's made a real difference. You know, children with disabilities have a right to a full and complete education, and the ADA generation kids understand that.
Yeah, I would agree, Cortland. And I think as well, you know, the ADA has ensured that people with disabilities have their basic civil rights protected, and that also have opportunities and a recourse of legal action, you know, if those civil rights aren't protected. And I think that's a very powerful thing.
Absolutely.
Has change come willingly? When the act was signed into law, did change come quickly, easily, and on which frontiers? And where has change been slow to come, even though it's codified now?
I think it was incremental, and we continued to see incremental change. Mm-hmm. For example, a lot of the changes in infrastructure that we enjoy now, things like ramps and elevators and automatic door openers, you know, those things weren't put into place overnight. So from the standpoint of physical access, change has been very incremental, and it's important to know that the ADA is more proactive than retroactive. So if you have an old building that you haven't renovated in 40 years that wasn't built under the premise or under the protection of the ADA, it probably still isn't accessible. And unless you choose to renovate it or get new permits to renovate it, you may not have to make it accessible. So really, what we really see is that new construction comes online. It comes online in a way that is accessible. So we've seen slow culture change in that regard.
For sure.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, shortly after President Bush signed the ADA into law, he also said, you know, let these shameful walls of exclusion come tumbling down. And while many of those walls have come tumbling down, there certainly continue to be many barriers. Mm-hmm. There's barriers to healthcare, yeah. Barriers to affordable, accessible housing. And that's a huge one for folks with disabilities. They may be access to jobs, but folks need a place to live. And that still continues to be a huge problem, not only in Massachusetts, but across the nation.
Yeah, I'd also
Let me just ask this one, just following on specifically what the two of you were just talking about. It makes me think of the, 5-year-long battle on Beacon Hill over sidewalk cutouts. The Beacon Hill Civic Association challenged that. There was a lawsuit. It took 5 years. Those cutouts weren't put in place until around May of 2019. So how do we think about those kinds of battles, given what you've just been saying?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point. And, you know, a lot of the battles and wins as it relates to access have been hard fought over the years. And there are still many ways in which, you know, the ADA has been very powerful and very impactful, but there are ways it's still limited. So, for example, if you have historical infrastructure that you feel, wherein you feel that making it accessible would be overly onerous or change the sort of nature, historic nature of the building, then you can get an exception to the ADA and that building can stay inaccessible. And that's where there's sometimes some gray area in terms of, you know, what is historic, what isn't historic, what's required. And so the law still has some limitations. I still think there's still large swaths of Boston that are completely very much inaccessible for people with mobility disabilities. You know, I'm a wheelchair user, and when I go to Newbury Street, for example, probably only about maybe max 25% of those businesses are accessible to me. So I simply don't shop there, you know, and there are areas of our city, that's one example, but there are several others where people with disabilities are still largely excluded, which is unfortunate because people with disabilities represent a very large market. You know, on the whole, it's 20 to 25% of our population. And it's a real miss from a business standpoint for a lot of small businesses to not be accessible to the whole community.
Absolutely.
Cortland, I've heard a number of arguments over the years, the Beacon Hill case being just one, that good design, good responsiveness to the requirements of ADA, good design for people with, for example, a mobility disability, really is good for everyone. Everyone benefits from those investments. You know, as Dr. Blowett just said, you improve your customer base, et cetera. So what do able-bodied listeners misunderstand about the ADA, about disability protections, about investments in disability accessibility that people need to understand?
Well, I mean, I think folks have to look at, I mean, the disability community is broad, okay? There's many, many different kinds of disabilities, and not all of them are mobility related. But the family of people with disabilities is one that you could join at any time. So there may be accessibility features that you may not need now, but that you may need later as a result of a change in your functional ability, whether it be from age, from a motor vehicle accident, from a stroke, or anything else. So if you look back at the concept that was once kind of a hot topic of like livable communities, people can understand that curb cuts don't just assist folks with disabilities who may be using a wheelchair, but also mothers with strollers, people that are pulling a shopping cart as they're going to the laundry. You know, elevators aren't just for people who are unable to ambulate, but it's also good for elders and people carrying packages. So, I mean, the argument of aesthetics, well, because this is historic and we like the cobblestones, aesthetics over accessibility has never been a valid argument for me. So if we really want to have an accessible society and access to the American dream for everyone, then the communities themselves have to be not only physically accessible, but also programmatically accessible.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Blowett, we're having this conversation during a global pandemic. The coronavirus is upon us. We've reported on this show racial disparities that are being laid bare by the pandemic and our healthcare system, how vulnerable populations are disproportionately vulnerable to the pandemic. I know these disparities aren't new, but how are they intersecting with the disability community during this coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up this important point. You know, really what we've seen is that the pandemic has laid bare many gaps and disparities to health in access to healthcare that prominently impact the disabled community, you know, similar to parallels we've seen as it relates to the Black community and people of color. I think some key examples of that, you know, for so many years, our healthcare system and the way we run our services has put up barriers to people living independently in the community. You know, it is easier for us in this country to institutionalize someone in a nursing home rather than to support them to live in their home, even though it's actually more cost effective to keep people in their home. It, of course, promotes empowerment and independence, and it's what people want. But because we've established and really promoted this context of nursing home care as a primary means of care across our communities, we've now seen a really devastating impact on our nursing home communities, which of course is primarily people with disabilities. Of course, there's also intersectionality here in that people with disabilities of color or people with disabilities who are poor are also more likely to live in institutionalized environments. So we've really seen this confluence of, you know, how we've established our infrastructure, our healthcare infrastructure, over the last several decades, unfortunately, predispose people with disabilities to being at much higher risk for acquiring the coronavirus or COVID-19, and of course, then being at higher risk for poor outcomes related to COVID-19. I'd say a couple of other major gaps that we've seen is that, you know, we've not done a good job historically in integrating data collection about disability within our broader healthcare infrastructure. There's been some recent progress around elements of race, ethnicity, preferred language, et cetera, but disability data is not collected. That makes it very difficult for us to know how the community is being impacted, whether or not there are disparities and gaps in things like testing for people with disabilities, whether people with disabilities are dying at a higher rate. You know, I think the answer is fairly intuitive, but frankly, it's not data driven. And that's a big gap, because data is what drives policy and drives funding. And that's something that we need to fix into the future.
And so I think Courtland, with that in mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, we have a delay. Of course, we're all in three different places due to the virus that we're talking about right now. Go ahead and add your point there.
No, I mean, as far as if you want some concrete data, like right now in Massachusetts, we have over 32,000 people that are living in nursing homes, right? Mm-hmm. And it's estimated that at least 10,000 of those people could be living in their own homes with the proper supports. So the Olmstead decision of 99 ruled that unjustified segregation of people with disabilities did in fact discriminate because it violates the ADA. And we all know that stable housing is one of the key determinants of health, right? But if you look at in this pandemic, as for the COVID-19, the highest death tolls, over 40% are amongst people living and working in nursing homes. That's over 45,000 people that have expired nationwide and over 5,300 people here in Massachusetts alone. And folks with disabilities are definitely represented amongst those with underlying medical conditions. So, you know, if you want to talk about, again, real integration, we have to be able to move folks out of nursing homes where they're more at risk, out of these institutional facilities, and move into the community where they can live independently, access the American dream, live it fully. You know, folks need some supports, you know, personal care attendants, supported living. There's a variety of them. But the key for our state really is a lack of affordable and accessible housing. Mm-hmm.
All right. So we have about 2 minutes left. And I want to ask you both just briefly from each of you, if there were an ADA 2.0 law to come forward today, what would be key provisions you'd want to see?
Good question. Well, you know, I'd say I think some key points for progress into the future. You know, I think that that policy change and legislation and laws can change infrastructure, and we've seen some impact there. But laws don't necessarily change culture. And so I think when we think to the future of what could have the biggest impact, we still have a lot of work to do as it relates to reducing our cultural bias and stigma around disability, understanding that disability is something that impacts, frankly, nearly everyone at some point in life. And that when we think about inclusive services, we need to understand that it's not just for a small subset of people in our society, but it's actually for everyone. So I would probably try to tackle it from the standpoint of thinking of how we can continue to make progress as it relates to things like the built infrastructure, things like accessibility and communications, things like closed captioning and accessible websites. But how do we really get at the cultural change to reducing stigma around disability and understanding that it's not a lesser way of living or something that needs to be devalued, but actually part of the ubiquitous life experience that we all face?
Thank Agreed. You for that. Courtland, I have about a half a minute left, please.
Again, I'd say education and enforcement. A law is only as good as it is enforced. And I think education about some of the things that we just talked about, you know, disability rights is human rights. Disability rights is civil rights. It needs to be taught in school. People need to understand how we got to where we are now. You know, it was a bipartisan move to pass the ADA, but it wasn't because it was some benevolent feeling. Folks worked and fought for it.
And that is Courtland Towns III, Deputy Director of the Boston Center for Independent Living, and Dr. Sherry Blauett, a sports medicine specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thanks to both of you for joining us to mark the anniversary this week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tatiana.
Okay, have you had that day or week yet this year where you are just done with 2020? illness and death, job losses, police violence, protesting during a pandemic, political strife. It has been a tough year so far. So where do you turn for hope and strength when it gets tough? Well, our next two guests turn to books and draw inspiration from great stories of overcoming. And that's what we're going to talk about for this next segment. And we want you to tell us about your favorite books, about overcoming, about resilience. What are you turning to read? Maybe there's something new that's moved you. Maybe there's an old standby that you've turned to again. Who are the role models, real or fictional, that show you the way forward now? Or maybe you're finding that you just can't pick up a book and you want to tell us about that. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. So our fellow travelers for this conversation, first we have Camille Washington. She hosts the culture podcast, The Unfriendly Black Hotties. Welcome back, Camille.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And Nick Petrolakis, who was the assistant manager of Brookline Booksmith. Welcome back to you as well, Nick.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So we are talking about resilience, stories that show us how to overcome. Nick, I'm going to start with you because, like many Americans, you've been furloughed from your position at Brookline Booksmith. It's got to be an extraordinarily tough time. So with that in mind, has it informed how you've thought about this concept, resilience, overcoming? How do you define it?
I would absolutely agree that it has forced me to rethink everything because, you know, I did something for, you know, 20 plus years and suddenly I'm not doing that. So turning to books, which I think is a wonderful touchstone for so many people. You know, it's they're not loud. You open them and they are activated when you read them. And so I find them, you know, amazingly effective to remind me that people have been, you know, through, of course, much, much worse than what I'm dealing with. And I, you know, enjoy seeing those stories unfold between the pages.
Camille, how about you? How are you thinking about this idea of resilience this year? So many people, 2020 has just been maybe one of the most challenging in their lifetimes.
Yeah, I think that there are many people who would like to return the year 2020 to the store if they could. And, you know, for me, as a Black woman, as a queer person, this summer has been especially challenging, and I've had to draw, you know, on a deep, deep well of resilience that doesn't always come naturally or easily. And it has really been wonderful during this time to turn to some of my favorite books and draw strength from them.
So I know that for both of you, the Black Lives Matter movement, the protests that are still happening across the country over police brutality and the death of George Floyd have been both on your minds. Let's start, Camille, I'll start with you. Let's actually talk about some books there. And again, listeners, call with your books. What stories of resilience are inspiring you? 1-800-423-8255. Camille, what are one or two books that you're turning to process that part of the moment in history we're in?
Well, the first book that comes to mind is When and Where I Enter, The Impact of Black Women on Race and Sex in America by historian Paula Giddings. And the story of Black women in America is fundamentally one of resilience. So it's a really obvious pick for me. And this book was blurbed by both Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou. So that's how you know it's good. It's a rich but eminently readable history of the contributions of Black women to public life in the United States from around 1840 to 1980. It's a really rich text. So if you do pick it up, I encourage you to give yourself plenty of space to read it over time. And it tells the story of well-known Black women like Ida B. Wells and Shirley Chisholm, but it also will inform you about, you know, some women that you might not have heard about, like Sadie T.M. Alexander, who was an accomplished scholar and lawyer who served under not one, not two, but three U.S. presidents.
So, Nick, people are picking up books in this space. People will go get the book, you know, Camille is recommending. We've seen Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me on the New York Times bestseller list. You had one or two you wanted to add to people's pile as well. What are they?
I did. You know, the books that you just mentioned are the ones that absolutely, you know, everybody wanted to get. There were a couple others. The first one that I thought of was When They Call You a Terrorist, which is a Black Lives Matter memoir. It was written by one of the women who launched the Black Lives Matter movement after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the murderer of Trayvon Martin. So this book, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement is a big part of the book, but the author, Patrice Kahn Cullors, also just talks about what it is like growing up poor and Black in America, and how she was, you know, forced to feel that being poor was her fault. If anything bad happened, it was her fault because she was poor in a poor neighborhood, which, of course, is, you know, frightening on so many different levels. But that, When They Call You a Terrorist, is just an amazing book, really a resilient writer. The other is They Can't Kill Us All by Wesley Lowery, who is a terrific young journalist. And this book stemmed after Michael Brown was killed, you know, yet another young African-American man who was murdered, this time, of course, by the police. So those are two books that are high on the list, but maybe weren't as popular as, you know, Between the World and Me or How to Be an Anti-Racist, which also, of course, are wonderful, wonderful books.
You know, I'd love to get your reaction to one that has really stayed with me. The book's about 10 years old now, but in this space, it's called The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson, and it's about the Great Migration. I think it was published in 2010, and tracks a number of families migrating from the South to the North over a 40-year period, and tells incredible stories of what people left, what people came to, how they built their families, and for me was just a deep education in a piece of our history in America that I was just not taught in school at all. I don't know if it's a book that either of you are familiar with. The fact that I got dead silence from both of you may mean I'm going to have to carry the torch on that one alone.
I was handing the microphone over. But no, that when that book came out, you know, was a huge, huge seller. That's one that, you know, in, you know, all the bookstores that I've been associated with has continued to sell incredibly well. And like you say, it was a piece of history that for me, I also was unacquainted with. And to see that modern day migration, like you say, going south to north, and what had to be left behind, and what they faced on that, you know, journey north. Yes, you know, just incredible. Wilkerson is just wonderful.
Yeah, and I would absolutely co-sign. I think that a lot of times what we're taught in schools about Black history is really like all around the civil rights movement. And it's like Black people don't exist like much before or after 1965. So it is nice to tell these other stories.
So Camille, I'm going to come back to you because I want to shift into fiction now. Sometimes what a fiction book can do is give us a chance to escape, but also either validate our reality or give us a way to make sense of it. Or maybe in this case, with stories of resilience or overcoming, role modeling what it means to truly tough it out. You've been on talking with us about Little Women in the past. I know you admired that book. Are there other fiction books that came to mind for you on this subject?
Yeah, there are a couple. The first is an oldie but a goodie, Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte.
Yes.
Now, if you haven't read this book since you were forced to in high school, I would really encourage you to crack it open again. I began my relationship with this book as, I think, an eighth grader, and it has become, over the years, my favorite book of all time. I mean, Jane Eyre is a kind of proto-feminist novel. She describes herself as poor, obscure, plain, and little, and she has to deal with all of that, in addition to being a woman in a time when women had little to no autonomy. So she has quite a lot to overcome. And Jane is resilient in the face of all that adversity, but I think the resilience that I'm most moved by in the book is Jane's moral resilience. Like, she would quite literally rather be starving and homeless than act outside her own values or sacrifice her independence. And I just think it was amazing as a young person and as a, you know, a woman in my early 30s now to have this example of someone who's committed to her own spirituality and morality in a way that honors her own passions and desires without robbing her of her integrity. And then quickly, the second one.
Endorse that.
Yeah, it's so good. And there are lots of great film adaptations as well. But the second book I want to recommend is Full Disclosure by Cameron Garrett, which is a young adult novel that focuses on an HIV positive teenager who's navigating high school and all the normal things that teenagers deal with, like making and keeping friends, falling in love, and just developing as a person. And the protagonist is the Black adopted daughter of two gay men, both of whom are also people of color. It's primarily a story of the resilience of HIV positive people, but it also touches on the resilience of queer folks and Black and brown people. So if there is a young person in your life that you want to, you know, share some of those important stories with, Full Disclosure is a great book for them.
Those are great recommendations. And Nick, I know you have Station 11 on your list, which really struck me. I loved it. I read it a few years ago and it felt more like fiction then than I think it would feel now.
That is the wonderful and scary thing about that book, because, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, why not go back to a book that is about a pandemic and a flu that decimates the population. What I loved about the book was that it begins with Shakespeare, which is how I want, of course, all of my pandemic post-apocalyptic books to begin. In this case, it's King Lear. And one of the stars dies on stage. And that's how the story begins. And then we flash forward 20 years after this pandemic has literally killed most of the population. But we have a traveling troupe called the Traveling Symphony that is itinerant, and they wander around the Great Lakes region, and they are artists doing, you know, the only thing that they know how to do. How prescient, though, Emily St. John Mandel was in her book to describe some of the things that are happening today is uncanny. What I loved about it, though, is that at the end, there is this moment where they realize that there's a community that has brought back electricity, and just that idea that civilization is beginning to flower again is amazing. And when it occurs on the page, it's just it's like you're coming up from air after having been held underwater for 5 minutes. So I loved Station 11.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Chris on the line from Jamaica Plain. Chris, what book do you want to talk about?
Oh, there are so many books. I'm a social studies history teacher, and I would say Ta-Nehisi Coates' 8 Years We Were in Power really captures 8 years during the Obama administration, but connects back directly to the history of enslavement and resistance. Also, we're in Boston, and Carrie Greenidge wrote a small book about Boston's Black abolitionists, and we are here in the center of Black resistance. I'd add Just Mercy to that list. And I have to say, as a person with a disability, Judy Heumann's book, Being Human, is helping me right now in this moment, because our state legislature just declined to update our state regulations to be in keeping with the ADA to add more accessible housing and accessible workplaces. A fight
so
that
Chris,
we
thank
are
you
gonna
for
continue.
That list. Yeah, and we've had both of those authors, those last two authors, Judy and Carrie Greenidge, both on our air in the last year or two. Let me turn back to our panelists and ask you for reactions to those recommendations.
I mean, Ta-Nehisi Coates is, you know, one of the great, great writers of our time. So I'm really glad to hear one of perhaps his lesser known books get a recommendation.
And I would absolutely second that. I mean, you know, Between the World and Me is such a powerful book, you know, being a letter to his son. But that earlier book, yes, also is just amazing. So co-sign, like you said.
So Camille, one of the books that you talked about in the fiction space was a YA book. And as I was getting ready for this segment and thinking about great stories of resilience, I just kept turning back to stories about young people, and often stories from, you know, children's stories and YA stories. Is there something about that genre, for lack of a better word, that's really relevant right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as we're seeing in all of the various protest movements today, that there's a certain hope that is particular to young people. I mean, youth is itself this really hopeful concept, right? Like all the future lays before you. How can we shape it into what we want it to be? And so I think in that way, stories about young people just kind of tap into that. They tap into that hope.
And Nick, you know, one of the other things I was thinking and listening to the two of you is it feels like some people are kind of diving into the darkness with their reading, with these challenging subjects and challenging texts, whereas others might want to escape. But I'm hearing more and more that people are diving in. Why do you think that is?
You know, for me, when it first happened and the craziness was sort of overtaking us all, and you know, we didn't know there at the beginning, you know, in March, how bad it was going to be. When we were talking about, I remember our events coordinator, you know, on March 1st was saying, well, are we going to cancel all of our events? And that was inconceivable. But when I went to books that I used to go to that were, you know, let's say funny books, lighter books, they just weren't resonating with me. Whereas, you know, talking about YA, if I picked up The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, that somehow, since it speaks so directly to where we are right now, it just resonated more. And, you know, we're lucky that you know, we have so many brilliant YA authors and that, you know, genre is so rich. But yeah, I don't know. I guess it's just the, you know, what my ear was looking for. And at this moment, I'm not looking for, you know, Good Day Sunshine. You know, I'm looking for revolution. And so that, I think, is why some people are gravitating one way rather than the other.
All right. I am on a hard clock here. I've got less than a minute. So lightning round. Your next book, Camille.
Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close by Aminat Tuso and Anne Friedman. It's a memoir of friendship as well as a research guide to sustaining deep friendships over years and through change.
And for me, Petrolakis?
Sorry. For me, it would be How Much of These Hills is Gold by C. Pam Zhang, which is just a wonderful retelling of the Western. And it takes that trope and it just turns it on its head. And instead of seeing it through the eyes of, you know, your typical white cowboy, it's told through the eyes of two young Chinese sisters who have recently been orphaned and are on a quest to bury their father during the Gold Rush.
I got to stop you there. So we've got Nick Petrolakis and Camille Washington. This was a blast. Sorry to be abrupt. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What does a young opera singer do during the coronavirus pandemic?
Oh, our degrees are sort of obsolete now, and like all our classes are like, what is even happening? But let's all play Animal Crossing and like, you know, make our little towns and like, here's some normalcy.
Like many millennials, they play video games. So maybe we should have asked, what happens when opera singers play video games?
Susie, pretty Susie, what's all this about? The geese are going barefoot.
Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell went to find out.
Sopranos Larissa Bainton and Celeste Pellegrino are playing the roles of Hansel and Gretel on a performance staged entirely with Nintendo's Animal Crossing.
Oh, how I wish Mother would only return.
So the stars are two video game characters with comically oversized heads, wide, colorful eyes, and adorable smiles plastered on their faces.
So I think it's just goofy and charming and silly and... yeah, I think it's funny, too. It's just, like, these little, like, baby-looking characters singing full opera.
That's Pellegrino. She and Bainton created the opera company Due Donne Productions while they were completing their master's degrees at New England Conservatory.
You're making me snore, don't be a bore.
The music is from German composer Engelbert Humperdinck. In case you've forgotten the fairy tale... it's about two young children lost in a forest who encounter a witch in a gingerbread house.
Just wait till you see the witch's house, the candy house.
19th century fairy tale operas and a modern video game may sound like opposites, but Pellegrino says combining the two felt natural.
Animal Crossing is where you get to design your own island world with fun, cute, animated characters. It's kind of like The Sims, if you've ever played The Sims, where you're kind of in a other reality, but the characters are much more cute, I would say.
Animal Crossing has been around for about 20 years, but it's in the midst of a massive resurgence. The newest version, which came out in March, sold 13 million copies in the first 6 weeks of its release. It's part of why it can be difficult, even now, to get your hands on the Nintendo Switch console. A core part of the appeal is that the game allows players to be together virtually, in real time. That's what made the production possible. While they recorded the music separately, all of the performers were able to act out their roles through the game as their own Animal Crossing avatars.
When you watch the opera and you hear it, it sounds like these people are in the same room and there's no visual reminder telling you that they're not. So it feels like this is performance that happened together. When you see the squares on Zoom, you know that they're not together. And the best part of live theater is experiencing something, I think, together.
That's Pellegrino again. Before the pandemic, Duedane Productions was planning 3 in-person operas and received grants to help them employ about 40 singers. Now, the future for any in-person productions is uncertain, says Bainton.
It's been like a uniquely devastating experience, and that singing is like one of the most dangerous like things you can do, and it's kind of like put the whole industry in chaos.
Bainton is among many in the industry experimenting with how to perform and connect with audiences remotely.
The kind of traditional way to do it is great, but like these other kind of new, maybe weird ways of doing it are also exciting, I think. Like it's nice to be able to be like, look, it doesn't have to be this like one way that everyone kind of thinks of it.
And as Pellegrino points out, cartoons and opera have been intertwined for decades. It pops up in episodes of the 90s show Hey Arnold, in SpongeBob SquarePants, and of course, Looney Tunes and Bugs Bunny.
I feel like if you ask anyone, they're going to know the Ride of the Valkyrie theme. They might not know that's the name, but they'll know what it is in their head. So I don't think this is totally out of left field. That being said, I think the video game is just like the next generation of that kind of cartoon.
They hope that this approach to opera will draw non-traditional audiences. Pellegrino says they have also received positive responses from opera lovers. Bainton said the most powerful thing about the project was performing again with other people.
I think we all felt kind of emotional, like watching it for the first time and hearing all of our voices together. And we were like, oh my gosh, like it sounds like we're together even though we were apart.
And that's Radio Boston Zoe Mitchell speaking with Larissa Bainton and Celeste Pellegrino of Duedane Productions. Hansel and Gretel premiered on Saturday, and it can be viewed anytime online. We'll have more information at radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.